Yeah. It was Desmond Doss and Jim Doris who climbed up the cargo net and stood at the top of the cliff for the photographer's benefit. "Come on up," Desmond called. He and Doris were fairly well concealed by the natural slope and the rock wall that had been built the first day. But the photographer did not appreciate the invitation. "I haven't lost anything up there," he explained. Fighting on the fire-swept escarpment by day, prey of the enemy slipping out of caves by night, even seasoned veterans began to show fear. All around him, Desmond saw the drawn faces, the staring eyes, the twitching hands of extreme mental strain. One of the top non-coms in the company sought out Desmond and told him,
"I can't go on any longer. My luck's run out. You can say I'm sick. You gotta send me back."
Doss shook his head. He understood the man's fears, but he could not approve.
"There's nothing the matter with you," he said. "Stop talking like that. Pull yourself together and you'll be all right."
He later heard that the sergeant was going around offering to pay other soldiers to shoot him in the leg or arm. On the other hand, a corporal, one of the original members of the company and a man who had given his best from the first day he had joined the outfit, came down with some ailment which resulted in high fever and swollen glands. His entire neck was swollen, red and painful to the touch. He couldn't turn his head. He had to move his entire body to look to the side. With such pain and under such a handicap, he could not possibly take care of himself on the escarpment. Desmond sent him back to the battalion aid station. A few hours later, here came the corporal back again. The medical officer at the aid station had told him to go back to duty and take it easy.
"How can you take it easy up here?" Desmond demanded.
He was actually angry.
"You go back to battalion aid station. You tell them that I said you are in no fit condition to be up here. If the doctor wants to see me about it, I'll come back and talk to him. But don't you come back up here. You understand?"
The little corporal with the swollen neck started the long trip back to the battalion aid station. Desmond watched him go.
"That's a good man with not one cowardly drop of blood in his entire body," he fumed for the benefit of anyone who would listen. "I won't let them send him back up here to get killed."
The dead lay everywhere. On top of the escarpment, both Americans and Japanese lay where they had fallen. Down below, the American dead were removed, but nobody took time to pick up the enemy bodies. A Japanese officer who had infiltrated the company area and killed two of Desmond's buddies before being killed himself lay sprawled over a rock. His dead hand still clutched his saber. That saber would have brought $100 from the souvenir hunters in the rear echelons or the Navy, but none of the men up front even looked at it. But all this death had to have some effect. Desmond worried more about the buddies he was losing every day than about himself. One day, moving like a sleepwalker, he went through the GI ritual of pouring some gasoline into a tin can, then throwing in a match to make a quick fire to heat his food. He sat on his heels and watched the flame. He felt moisture on his cheeks and brushed it away with his knuckles. For the first time, he realized that he was crying. Then he looked at the fire that he had just built.
"Why am I doing this?" he asked himself. "I'm not hungry."
He realized that he had to pull himself together, stop thinking about his good friends who had been killed, too many of them, and replace his trust in the Lord. The fighting for the escarpment continued day after bloody day, night after fearful night. Though the enemy had been pretty well cleared off the top of the hill, an area about as wide as a football field, the slope on the other side was dotted with pillboxes leading to the maze of tunnels beneath. By day, the Americans occupied the top of the hill, attempting to push forward. By night, the Japanese crept out of their holes and slithered soundlessly over the terrain. A key Japanese emplacement, really just a fortified gaping entrance to the tunnels beneath, was spotted just over the lip of the far slope of the escarpment. The Americans tried to hit it with mortars and artillery, but it was protected by the slope of the hill. Repeated efforts were made to knock it out. Sergeant John Mahalik, the popular non-com from the heavy weapons platoon, got close enough to throw a grenade in. The Japanese threw it right back out again. Under the cover of friendly fire, two engineers ran forward and dumped in a satchel charge. The Japanese pulled the fuses before it could explode. Someone at headquarters got the brilliant idea of fashioning a trough out of tin to run across the hill. Gasoline poured into the trough at the American side would flow across into the Japanese hole. Then a grenade thrown in would ignite it. But laying the trough was a clumsy operation, and there wasn't enough elevation for the gas to flow. Japanese continued to emerge from the hole.
"I'm gonna blast that hole if it kills me," Sergeant Mahalik said.
He led a squad of volunteers across the top of the escarpment to the lip of the hill. As his men covered him, he jumped up and ran toward the hole, a grenade in each hand. Bullets thudded into the sergeant's body as he ran. He staggered, then fell. His momentum carried him almost to the edge of the hole. He lay there, still. The grenades rolled on and exploded harmlessly.
"Mahalik's hit!"
The word got back to Doss. He was helping a wounded man on top of the escarpment. Though it was almost certain that Mahalik was dead, and Desmond was numb with exhaustion, he went forward without hesitation. He knew the respect the men had for Mahalik. A man from his squad accompanied Doss, and together they crawled almost to the very lip of the hole. They grabbed Mahalik's feet and dragged his body back up the hill and to the cover of a shell hole. There, Desmond examined him. John Mahalik was dead. From the nature of his wounds, he had probably died instantly. Word swept through the company and was taken back to the battalion headquarters by the wounded. Desmond Doss, who had risked his life so many times to save the wounded, had done it again for a dead man. That afternoon, Desmond had to go back to the battalion aid station to pick up supplies. Captain Tan greeted him with, of all things, an admonition.
"What's this I hear about you risking your neck to save a dead man?" he railed. "You'll only succeed in getting yourself killed that way, and dead medics are no good to anybody. If I ever hear of you doing anything like that again, I'll pull you back."
But even as he talked, his voice softened. Desmond Doss looked as if he had been fighting a war all by himself. His face was drawn. He was edgy and irritable. His hands trembled. His uniform was brown with the blood of men he had treated and dragged to safety, and with his own blood, for a flying rock had cut a nasty gash. The day was ending.
"You're going to spend the night here, Doss,"
Captain Tan told him.
"Oh, no, Captain, I'd better get back to the company,"
Desmond said.
"You'll stay here, and that's an order,"
Tan said.
"We're going to feed you and see to it that you get some sleep. I don't even want you to pull any guard duty."
After chow, the captain directed Desmond to a quiet cave. An underground stream bubbled with a soothing sound. After his nightly prayers, Desmond opened up a litter and stretched out on it. Before he could really appreciate the security, the quiet, and the soft murmur of the brook, he was sound asleep. In the morning, refreshed after his first full night's sleep since going up to the escarpment, Desmond realized how close he had been to complete exhaustion, both physical and mental. Before he left the aid station, litter bearers brought in a lieutenant from another company. He was a young officer, and he was worried that all of his men were going to be killed in a forthcoming attack.
"I've got to get to them! I've got to get to them!"
he kept crying.
"Don't you understand? Help me get to my men!"
His eyes were bloodshot, his nose running, his face contorted. He kept trying to get off the litter, but he was in such an hysterical state that he could barely move his arms. When Desmond last saw him, he was lying there, weeping helplessly.
"That almost happened to me,"
Desmond thought, and resolved again, with the help of God, to keep his nerves under control. It was another rough day on the escarpment. Doris was wounded. Now Desmond was the only medic for the entire company. He holed up that night with Gornto and five of his riflemen. Surely this would be a large enough force both to enable him to get some rest between standing guard duty and to guarantee protection against enemy soldiers infiltrating the company area. They had found an indentation in the side of the cliff against which a flat rock leaned, and had piled up fired mortar shells filled with rocks to close in one side. A rock parapet stood on the other side. Desmond pulled guard first. Nearby, a mortar squad was firing, keeping the Japanese from moving around on top of the escarpment. After several whoomps, he heard a different sound, the explosion of a grenade. Desmond saw, standing on the parapet outside, outlined against the sky, a Japanese soldier.
"Lieutenant,"
he whispered, and pointed the soldier out to Gornto.
"We'll get him,"
Gornto said, but firing from the darkness through the narrow aperture was difficult. The bullets missed, but the Japanese saw the flashes. He began trying to throw grenades through the opening. It was just a question of time before he'd get one in and wipe out all seven of them. The men inside were trapped. Desmond realized that this time, death was inevitable. He started to pray for Gornto and the other men, as well as for himself. And the Lord heard his prayer. Gornto had left his pack outside the cave. In it were two white phosphorus grenades. The next grenade flung by the Japanese landed on that pack. Somehow, instead of exploding, the phosphorus grenades merely burned. A great cloud of white smoke resulted. The wind was just right, and it blew over the enemy soldier. He couldn't take it.
Let's get out of here,
Gornto hollered. One after the other, they squeezed through the narrow aperture. Desmond, handicapped by his aid kits, had to let the others go first. The billowing clouds of smoke had almost dissipated by the time he got out of the cavern. Running hard in the darkness, he was on Gornto's heels. Suddenly, the shadowy silhouette of the lieutenant became two silhouettes. The Japanese had stepped out to block his path. Desmond piled into the two scuffling forms and bounced off to the side. He felt himself falling. He'd gone over the edge of the parapet. He and his equipment hit the bottom with a thud. An agonizing pain shot through his left leg. It would not bear his weight, but he couldn't stay there. The ammunition dump was nearby, with sentries posted. Dragging his leg behind him, announcing his identity in hoarse whispers, Desmond crawled to the dump, found a hole, and burrowed in. Feeling his leg with his fingers in the dark, he found that it was bleeding badly and placed dressings on it to stop the blood. He could do nothing further, so he went back to sleep. Dawn came. Desmond knew he should evacuate himself and his bad leg back to the battalion aid station. He could do his wounded buddies no good up here if his leg would not permit him to get to them. Yet he did not go. He was the only medic left, not just of Company B, but of the entire force at the escarpment. A medic with only one leg was better than no medic at all. It was Saturday, May 5th, the Sabbath. Breakfast over, he took his Bible and lesson pamphlet out of his pack and sat down, his back against a rock. For just a moment he allowed his thoughts to dwell on Dorothy, his parents, and his friends back home, going to church on a peaceful Sabbath far from the sounds of war. He did not envy them. By being here in this terrible place, he knew he was doing his share to make it possible for them and all Americans to continue worshiping their God according to their own beliefs as a part of their heritage. He opened his lesson and began to read.
"How are things up on the hill?"
The voice came from a full colonel standing above him. Desmond started to scramble to his feet, bad leg and all, but the colonel motioned him to stay where he was.
"I haven't been up there this morning, sir," Desmond said. "Our company CP is right over there, and you can check with them,"
the colonel nodded.
"I want to see how our artillery is doing," he said,
and proceeded on to the cargo nets. Desmond turned back to his lesson. Several minutes went by. Then, from the top of the cliff, came the familiar cry,
"Medic! Medic!"
Desmond looked up at the men calling him. It was the Sabbath, and he only had one good leg. Nevertheless, he answered.
"What's the matter?"
"That colonel! The artillery spotter! He's been hit bad!"
the men shouted down. Without thinking, Desmond grabbed his aid kits, jumped up, and started toward the cliff. His weight fell on his bad leg, and it buckled under him. He went down, hard. Someone gave him a hand up.
"Oh, Lord, please help me,"
Desmond murmured. Again, he put his weight on his bad leg. It held. One step, two, and then he realized that his bruised and wrenched leg was not paining him a bit. With his aid kits slung over his shoulders, he climbed the net to the top of the cliff, then carefully made his way toward the shell hole where the injured colonel lay. Bullets whined over his head, and mortars and artillery shells burst on the hill. He paid no attention. By now, he was used to the sound of death. He reached the shell hole and jumped in with the injured, unconscious colonel. A piece of shrapnel from a shell burst had shattered his arm and then ripped its way right on through his chest and back. He was bleeding heavily and breathing through the hole in his chest. Desmond shouted to a man in the nearest shell hole to pass the word back that he needed blood plasma, and quick. He selected his largest battle dressings and tied them over the two large holes, front and back, to stop the gush of blood and the chest breathing. He had finished the bandaging job when a soldier slid feet first into the hole with him. He had brought the blood plasma. Desmond inserted the large transfusion needle into a vein in the colonel's arm. In order for the plasma to drain from the container into the vein, it was necessary to hold it high. This meant exposing himself to the enemy just over the hill. Feeling naked, Desmond knelt there in full view of two armies, letting the life-giving plasma flow into the wounded man's vein. From behind, his men shouted at him to get down and fired across to give him protection. Another man skidded in with a litter. As Desmond held the container of plasma, the two men in the hole with him opened up the litter and eased the limp form onto it. The trip back toward the edge of the cliff, running, bent over, carrying the colonel, was a rough haul. The surgical dressings had slipped, and the bleeding had commenced again. Desmond tied the dressings back. The transfusion needle had slipped out of the vein. Desmond tried to get it back in, but the vein had collapsed. He sent word to the battalion aid station that he had a colonel in serious condition and needed help. Captain Tan and Sergeant Howell appeared, but they were not able to get the needle back into the collapsed vein either.
I think we'd better get him back to the hospital, Tan said. We're not doing him any good here.
Four men picked up the litter and started carrying the colonel back toward the aid station. He died before he got there. Desmond returned to his Sabbath school lesson. Again he was interrupted, this time by Captain Vernon.
Das, the captain said, we have orders to move across the hill and take that pillbox no matter what the cost. Lieutenant Phillips is leading the attack. I know it is your Sabbath, and I know you don't have to go on this mission, but the men would like to have you with them, and so would I.
I'll go, Captain, Doss said without hesitation. His savior had treated men on the Sabbath, and he could do no less.
But I'd like to finish my Sabbath school lesson first.
Captain Vernon opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. He studied his company aid man for a moment. Doss's cotton uniform was dark brown and stiff with dried blood, the blood of the men whose lives he had saved and attempted to save. His eyes were sunk deep in their sockets with exhaustion. Vernon knew that he had seriously injured his leg and had nevertheless just gone out under fire to do his best to save a wounded man. How many men had Doss saved since this bloody battle had begun? The captain could not count them. Vernon nodded in agreement.
We'll wait for you.
Captain Vernon did not tell his company aid man that orders for this special mission had come down from 10th Army to Corps to Division to Regiment to Battalion to Company B. The entire American advance in Okinawa, a line several miles across and involving several divisions, was being held up by this one strong position. From the escarpment, the Japanese dominated the terrain on either side. It could truly be said that the success of the Okinawa campaign rested on this mission, and Captain Vernon delayed it so that one tired Sabbath keeper could read his Bible. Not knowing he was holding up a war, Desmond reached the conclusion of the lesson. He closed his Bible, bowed his head, and finished with a prayer. He stood up. Again, his bruised leg miraculously supported him.
I'm ready when you are, Captain.
The entire 1st Battalion was in on the attack, although Company B was to spearhead it. The company had been built up to well over 200 men for the Okinawa campaign, but after a week on the escarpment, its fighting strength was down to 155 men. These men were going into an even bigger battle than their worst fears, far bigger than the generals and their intelligence experts realized. None of them had any way of knowing that the entire Japanese strategy was keyed on this day. In every island battle prior to Okinawa, the Japanese had contested the Americans on the beachhead. This time, their strategy was different. It was to permit the Americans to come on to Okinawa, all six divisions of them, unopposed. When the entire American force was on shore, a swarm of kamikazes would be unleashed to sink the American fleet and cut off the supply lines. That would leave the forces stranded on the island. The second step in their strategy was to wipe out those forces. The place chosen, a line anchored on the Maida escarpment, the most favorable terrain on the island for a counterattack. The time, that very day, May 5th. The first part of the program had failed. The kamikazes had proved to be only a nuisance. But the second phase, the counterattack, was scheduled to go on nonetheless. The high commands of two great forces, many miles apart, had chosen this very day to attack. Their point of contact was the escarpment. As the Japanese waited in their holes for 0 hour, the Americans were beginning their advance. In the center was the 77th Division. At the apex of its attacking wedge, the 307th Regiment, the 1st Battalion, Company B, and finally, Lieutenant Phillips and his hand-picked group of 5 volunteers. Their mission, the final assault on the big pillbox on the reverse slope of the hill. The 6 men, covered by sweeping fire from the rear, crossed the broad top of the hill and crawled down the reserve slope toward the big hole. Each man carried a 5-gallon can of gasoline. At Phillips' signal, they removed the caps and tossed the cans in the hole. Phillips waited a moment, then tossed in the white phosphorus grenade. There was silence for a moment. Then a mighty rumble. The entire hill shook. Phillips and his men held on tight and looked at each other in wonder. This was more than they had expected. Far down beneath them, an ammunition dump had obviously gone off. A few moments later, the officers, observing from the hills far to the rear across the valley, and from the plains overhead, saw a strange phenomenon. Puffs of white smoke came out of 100 holes and crevices on top of the hill and from the slopes on all sides. And out of many of those holes, even those on the American side, poured Japanese soldiers. They came running, screaming, firing rifles and throwing grenades. This was the counterattack on which the Japanese pinned all their hopes. The whole thing reminded Desmond of hitting a hornet's nest with a stick and seeing it erupt. The Americans met them head on. Captain Vernon brought every man up on the escarpment, and the force dug in and held. But then the sheer weight of numbers and firepower, both from in front and from the rear, proved overwhelming. At first, there was the semblance of an orderly retreat, but then panic set in. Officers and non-coms were ranging up and down the hill, shouting, threatening, trying to keep the men falling back in an orderly fashion. Some of the non-coms pointed their guns at their men, threatening to shoot anyone who fled. But panic and hysteria swept over the hilltop, and the entire battalion, or what was left of it, began running back toward the cliff. Those men hit by enemy bullets and shells were left to lie where they had fallen, whether wounded or dead. In the midst of this mad rush was the one remaining medic in the whole battalion, Desmond Doss. He ran from one fallen man to the other, doing what he could. He didn't think of saving his own skin. He was too busy. He didn't think about the Japanese soldiers on the hilltop with him, shooting and throwing grenades. God had looked after him before. Why would he stop now? Trained as a medical soldier, secure in his conviction that when he was aiding his fellow men, God was looking after him, Desmond Doss went calmly about his business of aiding the wounded, the only sane man on a hilltop mad with murder and fear. Some of the other men, seeing him going about his business, were shamed into halting their pell-mell rush to the rear. Some gave him a hand with the wounded, helping them, dragging them to the edge of the cliff. But for hours it seemed to Desmond as though he was up there alone on top of the escarpment, raked by enemy fire, treating the wounded, pulling them back to the edge, then going back for more. Those men who had been able to make their way down the cargo nets had collapsed and lay panting, regathering their breath and their senses. How long they had been there, nobody really knew, when one of them happened to look up to the top of the cliff. He saw Desmond Doss standing there alone, the last unwounded man. The next thing the man at the bottom of the cliff knew, a litter with a wounded soldier strapped on it was being slowly lowered down the face of the cliff. Desmond had tied the man on it, had then taken a turn of the rope around the shattered stump of a tree, and was slowly paying out rope to permit the litter and its human burden to descend. A few feet from the bottom, the rope securing the soldier to the litter slipped, and the unconscious man almost fell off, but a couple of men ran forward to steady the litter.
"Take him off!"
Doss shouted down to them from above.
"I've got more men up here! Send this one straight back to the aid station! Non-stop! He's bad off!"
The men at the bottom untied the litter and removed the wounded man. They started to tie the litter back onto the rope, but Desmond stopped them.
"I don't want it!"
he called down. He had seen that first man nearly slip off, and, somehow, amidst all the confusion, his memory produced a picture in his mind. He remembered how he had tied a bowline in a double length of rope during mountain climbing in West Virginia. Now he doubled the end of the rope and tied that bowline. The result was two loops. Two loops that would not slip. The area at the top of the cliff was covered with wounded men, conscious and unconscious. Desmond chose one of the men who seemed to be the most seriously injured. He slipped one of the man's legs through one of the loops of his bowline, the other leg through the other loop. Then he passed the rope around the man's chest and tied another bowline there. Now, holding on to the end of the rope, he gently rolled the wounded man over the edge of the cliff and, using the friction of the loop around the tree as a brake, let him down to the ground beneath.
"That man's seriously injured!"
he called down.
"Get him back to the aid station non-stop!"
In that way, working alone, the only able-bodied man on the entire hilltop, Desmond lowered one man after another to safety and treatment beneath. He was partially protected by the slope and the rock wall, but as it was necessary for him to remain standing during several steps of the complete procedure, his head and shoulders were often exposed. Why did not Japanese bullets seek him out? Again, Desmond accepted it as the beneficent will of his God. Why did the Japanese, who had already chased the Americans back across the hilltop, not follow up their advantage? Only they knew. Perhaps the underground explosion had wrecked too great a toll for them to be able to mount their planned counterattack. Perhaps the artillery and mortar fire that Vernon called down on the top was sufficiently effective. At any rate, Desmond remained on top of the cliff until he had lowered every wounded man to safety. How many men were there? No one counted. Only after it was all over and the full immensity of his actions began to sink in through the minds of the men who had witnessed it, did anyone begin to estimate the number. Captain Vernon and Lieutenant Gornto recalled that a total of 155 men had taken part in the abortive assault. They took a quick head count. Only 55 men were on their feet at the base of the cliff. The difference? 100 men was the number they credited Desmond with saving. He protested. There couldn't have been more than 50. It would have been impossible for me to handle any more than that.
We'll split the difference with you, Captain Vernon proposed. The official record will state 75 men saved by PFC Dawes.
Frightening and costly as the Japanese counterattack had been, it marked the last action on the escarpment. When the Japanese did not follow up their advantage, the Americans went back up on the hill, and this time, they stayed. The next day, Company B, or what was left of it, was replaced with a fresh unit. Doss went back with them, tired to the very marrow of his bones. Again, Captain Tan and Sergeant Howell welcomed him. Tan looked at Desmond's uniform and shuddered. It was completely stiff and brown with dried blood and covered with flies.
We're gonna get you a new uniform, he promised.
Armies do not carry luxuries as clean uniforms, even for such bloody campaigns as Okinawa. Cargo space is taken up by such essentials as ammunition and food. But somehow fresh fatigues were found for the medic who had saved 75 men in one action. Desmond went back to the supply depot to get them. He scrubbed from the skin out, shaved, then put on his new uniform. If he'd had on a full dress uniform, he couldn't have been more impressive. An army photographer was rounded up to take a picture of a company aide man in a new uniform. The commanding officer of the division, Major General A.D. Bruce, had heard of Desmond's heroism and wanted to talk to him personally. He came all the way up to the battalion aid station to see him. That was when Desmond was getting his new uniform. Next day, Desmond received an even greater present. It was a huge package from the States. Over the years, Desmond had always listened to the Adventist radio program, The Voice of Prophecy. He had contributed to it for a long time. Following the Leyte campaign, in gratitude to the Almighty for sparing him during that bloody operation, Desmond sent in another contribution to the Voice of Prophecy. In this communication, he asked Elder H.M.S. Richards, the Adventist evangelist who conducted the program, to send him some books for distribution among the company. And now the books had arrived. Desmond got a big thrill out of unpacking them, passing them around to the men of the company. The number worked out perfectly. There was one book for every man, and one left over. The largest book was The Great Controversy, perhaps the most famous volume in the Adventist library, and Desmond presented it to the entire company to be kept in the field desk. It was a fitting end to the Battle of the Escarpment. There was talk of another decoration to go with the Bronze Star he had won on Leyte. The officers wanted to recommend him for 2 Purple Hearts, one for the gash caused by the ricocheting rock, one for the injured leg. Although many a Purple Heart has been given for less, Desmond said one to cover both actions would be enough. More important than a medal was the knowledge that he had been able to take care of the men he loved and send many of them back to their families. It had been a busy Sabbath. Chapter 6. The Last Patrol. After just 2 weeks of rest, Company B, with 93 replacements and several of the old men back after recovering from minor wounds and shock, returned to action. The few men who had been with it from the beginning might well have thought that by now they had seen everything, yet a completely new type of action had been assigned to them. Captain Vernon took his key men, including Desmond, to the top of the hill known as Chocolate Drop, a mile or two past the escarpment, and pointed out the next hill. This would be their objective. Vernon's finger traced in the intervening valley a series of towers for a power line leading to the objective. Some had been knocked down.
We'll guide on those towers, he said, and it's a good thing we've got something to guide on, because this is going to be a night attack. The Japanese have been attacking all night, all through the war. Well, we're going to give them a taste of their own medicine.
We're going to pull out at 2:30 in the morning and hit that position before dawn.
As usual, the weather was cloudy with intermittent showers. There would be no moon that night. To enable each man to follow the one in front of him, Desmond handed out small gauze patches to be placed on the back of each man's pack. He hoped that the white spots could be seen in the dark. Lieutenant Gornto had come down with pneumonia during the battle for the escarpment. A young officer replaced him. When the men started out through such utter darkness that they could not even see the white patch on the man in front of them, they had the chill feeling that this mission could not possibly end in anything but disaster. But such was the leadership of Captain Vernon that even the new men who had known him for but a few days followed with only a nominal amount of complaining. They moved on through the torn-up terrain in a column of threes. The white squares might have been pitch black. They weren't visible. After several men had gotten lost, word was passed back for each man to hang on to the one in front of him. Occasionally, flares went up, illuminating the valley in a harsh, white light. Every man fell face down on his hands so that no white would show. There was to be no sound. Rifles were emptied, bayonets attached. One Japanese soldier was encountered. Vernon gave one of his officers permission to put one shell in his carbine and use it. Before long, they had lost the path of the shot-up power structures. Frequent stops had to be made for the officers to check their compasses and to enable the men to catch up and get organized. But even then, as they neared the objective, the platoons became separated. No one will ever know for sure, but some of the men have always suspected that it was one platoon firing on another rather than the Japanese that gave their position away. No longer could they hope to make a surprise attack. The Japanese began throwing grenades. Two men were killed immediately. The rest sought cover. More by feel than by sight, Desmond knew that the company had passed over the brow of a small hill and was proceeding down the backside when the shooting started. He and two riflemen stumbled into a shell hole and stayed there. One of the men grabbed Desmond by the arm.
"Look!"
came a hoarse whisper. A Japanese soldier was silhouetted dimly against the skyline. He moved, and Desmond saw the sputtering fuse of a hand grenade coming straight to the shell hole. It landed right at his feet. The two other men were on the other side of the hole. Instantaneously, by reflex action, like a farm boy getting close to a kicking mule, Desmond put his foot on the grenade. A split second later, it exploded. He felt a jolt. It didn't hurt. Rather, it numbed him. He felt as though he was flying through the air head over heels. It knocked all the wind out of him. He shook his head and opened his eyes. He was still alive. The two men in the hole with him had gone, but the Japanese soldier was still there. Another grenade came sputtering through the night, but missed. Without thinking of how badly he was hurt, Desmond crawled out of that hole. Making his way through the underbrush, he called softly, over and over,
"It's Dawes! I'm hit!"
No one answered. He kept crawling until he was out of range of the grenades. From far away, he heard someone say that the company was withdrawing. He started crawling up the hill, dragging his left leg after him. It was throbbing all the way down from hip to toe. He ran his hand along his thigh, down the calf. It was wet with blood all the way down. He realized that he had lost and was still losing a lot of blood, but he could not stop in the midst of the retreat to attend to himself. He felt himself passing out.
What do you do for shock and loss of blood? You elevate the patient's feet.
Dutifully, Desmond squirmed around so that he was lying with his head pointing downhill. He remained in that position until he felt the consciousness returning with the blood running into his brain. He began doggedly crawling up the hill again until he started blacking out, then turned around to lie with his head downhill. Finally, he reached the top of the hill and started down the other side. The first light of dawn was beginning to appear. He came to a shell hole.
"Who's there?"
a voice whispered.
"Me. Dawes." "Oh, you're just the man I wanted to see,"
the soldier said.
"I've been hit in the shoulder."
Working in the dim light, Desmond dressed the man's wounds. Then he checked himself. Reaching down into his trouser leg, he felt dried clots of blood, like pebbles. He pulled out a handful, but he couldn't work through his bloody trouser leg, and he pulled his pants off. He felt down his left leg. Blood was running out of holes from his buttocks on down to his ankle. He could feel pieces of metal embedded in his flesh. He bandaged himself as best he could. He knew he could crawl no farther and resigned himself to staying in the hole until daybreak. At least he had company. The hole was shallow, and he borrowed the soldier's shovel and tried to dig it out more. It was hard going, and he gave up. He blacked out with his feet sticking out of the hole. When he opened his eyes, it was light. He looked around him. The first thing he saw was a large artillery shell, unexploded, just inches from his head. He had been digging around it with a shovel. If he had hit it... The thought of that knocked him into full consciousness. The man with the shoulder wound had also lapsed into a coma, but Doss managed to rouse him. They decided to stay where they were and hope litter-bearers would find them. Now Doss's wound was extremely painful. He took out a morphine syrette and showed the other soldier how to inject it. But the rifleman, squeamish about sticking the needle in his skin, squirted most of the morphine on his sleeve. Desmond finally gave himself the shot. The company was beginning to pull itself together again. Desmond heard someone shout that Captain Vernon had been hit. He shouted back, and he started dragging himself in that direction. But Vernon came to him. Blood flowed out of the captain's mouth and dripped off his chin. A fragment of a hand grenade had passed through his mouth and out through his cheek. "You have to go back, Captain," Doss told him. Captain Vernon gave a short little laugh.
"I'm staying up here with my men, Doss," he mumbled through his torn mouth.
Desmond knew it was useless to argue with him. He patched up the wound as best he could.
"Our artillery is going to drop a barrage on this area this morning," Vernon said. "We got to get word back to hold it."
But they had no communications. The company's radio was shot. Messengers were sent out. One located another unit with a functioning set, and they sent word to headquarters to call off the artillery. In the meantime, of course, no litter bearers came into the area. Finally, they arrived. One of them, T5 Ralph E. Baker, knew Doss well. He immediately took over and quickly had his friend and fellow medic on the way back to the battalion aid station. They had a long way to hike through a dangerous area on a day that had turned hot and muggy. Desmond drifted in and out of consciousness. He woke up with a jolt. Shells cracked through the trees. Enemy tanks fired in their direction. The four litter bearers had dropped to the ground, and Desmond had hit the dirt with them. The pain was agonizing, and it brought him completely to his senses. He looked around. Not 10 feet away lay another wounded American soldier. Blood was all over his head, but he was breathing. Desmond instantly knew that this man's wound was more serious than his own. When the shooting subsided and the four litter-bearers got ready to proceed, Desmond rolled off the litter. "This man's hit in the head," he said. "You'd better take him." Baker and the other three men protested vigorously. Desmond was their friend.
"You're the one we started out with, Doss," Baker said. "We want to get you back safely."
"No, sir," Doss insisted. "You know that a head wound takes precedence. You get this man back. I can last a long time yet. Nobody knows how long this guy can last."
He finally convinced them. They rolled the unconscious man on the litter and left Desmond there alone. But before long, someone else came along the trail. Doss recognized him immediately. He was Lewis Brooks from Richmond. He had been hit, but he could walk, and he offered to help Doss as best he could. Doss climbed to his feet and put his left arm around Brooks' neck. Brooks supported him with an arm around his waist. They started hobbling over the beat-up terrain toward the aid station. Something hit Desmond's arm, the one around Brooks' neck, like a blow from a hammer. Instantly after, he heard a rifle shot. Sniper! The bullet passed through Desmond's forearm and lodged in his upper arm. He knew it had broken the bones both above and below the elbow. But if it hadn't been for his arm, it would have hit Brooks in the chest or throat. The two men hit the ground. They spotted a shell hole and wormed their way to it. Desmond had to hold on to his arm to keep it from flapping loosely. Crawling with one leg and two arms out of commission was not easy.
"What can we do?" Brooks wanted to know. "There aren't any medics to help you."
"Huh, you're all the medic I need."
"Who, me?"
Brooks asked.
"What can I do?"
"I'll show you. Give me the stock of your rifle."
Brooks took his rifle down and threw the barrel away. Desmond had left his aid kits back on a hill, but he still had his field jacket with him. He handed it to Brooks.
"Here, wrap the stock in this. Now, see if you can tear some strips off my shirt and tie my arm to it. Then, tie the whole thing against my side."
Lying in the shell hole, Brooks managed to do it. Then they started out again. They could only hope that the sniper had moved on. Both of Desmond's wounds were now excruciatingly painful. The pieces of metal in his leg and buttocks, 17 in all, cut his flesh and scraped against the bone whenever he moved his leg. He suffered from shock and loss of blood.
I can't walk any farther,"
he suddenly told Brooks.
"Do you want to sit down?" Brooks asked.
Desmond thought about that a moment. Sit on what? That ripped and torn buttock?
"No,"
he said.
How about lying down, then? Brooks asked. Desmond could only shake his head. Things got blacker and blacker. He felt himself slowly crumpling to the ground. Chapter 7 The Greatest Honor.
Corporal,
the voice behind him called.
Corporal Dawes.
Desmond started and pulled himself out of his reverie. Outside the hospital window, the countryside of his beloved Virginia was beginning to turn red and brown and yellow with the colors of fall. Desmond turned around and began trying to stand at attention. Standing there was Colonel Hackett L. Connor, commanding officer of the hospital. He had a most un-colonel-like grin on his face.
As you were, Corporal,
he said, putting Desmond at ease.
Your promotion just came through, and I thought I'd tell you about it myself.
Thank you, sir, Desmond answered. In spite of the colonel's friendly tone, Desmond could not relax completely. He still found it hard to believe he was really here. Home. Safe. Alive. Near his loved ones. The war over. For months he had been living in a world of half-blissful dream, half-horrid nightmare. The war had gone on so long, so terribly long. He had awakened at the battalion aid station. They'd given him a massive shot of morphine, and he went back into a fog. Then he found himself in a field hospital far behind the lines, sitting on an operating table. The pain was excruciating, both where he sat and where the doctors manipulated his broken arm.
I can't sit down,
he muttered.
It hurts.
You have to. It's the only way we can get this cast on,
one of the doctors insisted.
I don't want to sit down,
Doss murmured. He felt himself slipping into unconsciousness again. Suddenly, a piercing odor went up his nose and his head cleared. Someone had broken an ammonia capsule under his nose.
You've got to stay awake, someone ordered.
Keeping him conscious with ammonia and conversation, the doctors and their assistants put a plaster cast on the entire upper part of his body. The cast held his arm out parallel with the ground, but bent at the elbow. When the plaster hardened, they finally let him get off his torn rear end. Then they could give him ether, and they put him under before they started extricating the jagged pieces of metal embedded in his leg. Later, in an ambulance, he bumped over an Okinawan road to the harbor where a hospital ship waited. A big, clumsy cast covered him from the waist to the neck. Bandages coiled around his ripped leg. What part of him was left was stark naked under the GI blanket.
His Bible! Where was Dorothy's Bible?
He felt for it with his good hand. It wasn't there. At the dock, he called the ambulance driver.
My Bible,
he gasped.
I've lost my Bible.
Sure, soothed the driver.
They'll get you one on the ship.
No, no,
Desmond cried, almost in hysterics.
I want my Bible, the one my wife gave me.
He insisted that the driver pass the word to his friends at the battalion aid station, asking them to look for his Bible with Dorothy's letter in it. In his agitation, he didn't realize what a forlorn hope that was. You don't call off wars to search the jungle for a Bible. Gradually, he came around. His leg began to heal, although it would be some time before he could walk on it. The plaster cast was miserably uncomfortable, but Desmond knew he could live with it because he was going home. The hospital ship took him to Guam. From there, he was flown to Hawaii, where he remained for several impatient weeks. Inside the cast, he felt filthy. He couldn't stand his own smell. He saw another patient in a light cast made of aluminum tubing.
Why can't I have one of those?
He asked one of the ward attendants.
Because yours is in fairly good shape,
the attendant explained, and looked at his fellow medic meaningfully. Desmond got it. He began working on his cast, soaking it, picking at it, and it didn't take him long to wreck it. He got his new, light airplane splint. Finally, 2 months after he'd been hit, he reached the United States. From Fort Lewis, Washington, he called Dorothy and heard her voice again for the first time in 2 years. Each leg of the long journey home took an agonizingly long time. It was military policy to send each man as close to home as possible. Desmond wound up at the Army Hospital at Swannanoa, North Carolina. His mother and father came to see him there. Dorothy, however, had gone back to college and was within days of getting her degree. Desmond was promised a furlough as soon as he could get around, and he insisted that Dorothy stay on and graduate. By that time, he could come to her. Finally, that day came.
His arms stuck out clumsily in the crowded bus, and the granulated tissue in his leg wounds was painful, especially where he sat down. But he was going home. Desmond had fought through 3 major campaigns, maintaining his composure and determination while others about him cracked from the strain. In a crowded bus station more than 10,000 miles from the fighting front, in the arms of his loved one, Desmond finally permitted the tears to course unashamedly down his cheeks. They were tears of joy. In the midst of this happiness, he did not forget to thank the Lord above for deliverance from death. Out of his monthly pay, he took a second tithe for his church, in gratitude for being permitted to return alive. While at Swannanoa, he received a warm and welcome letter from his friend Sergeant Howell in the medical battalion. All Desmond's old buddies sent their best. The division newspaper had published an exciting account of his heroism on the escarpment. Howell enclosed it. There was talk that Desmond was being recommended for a high decoration, perhaps even the Congressional Medal of Honor. One news item shocked and saddened him. Captain Vernon had been killed when a mortar shell scored a direct hit on the company command post. And they had found Desmond's Bible. The whole company had turned out to look for it. Desmond saw, in his imagination, the green-clad soldiers fanning out, poking in shell holes under debris, all the time keeping a sharp lookout for booby traps and snipers. He couldn't hold back the tears. To think that those men would do that for him. It could only mean that they felt for him the love and respect he felt for them. Not only was the Bible hunt a great compliment and tribute to him, but he also gloried in the realization that this search for the Holy Bible surely brought those men closer to God. The Bible was sent to Dorothy. Though waterlogged with the cover falling off, it was still in reasonable condition, and later Desmond had it rebound. Tucked in its place was the lesson he had been working on, dated May 26, 1945. He had been wounded on May 21st, a Monday. When finally the bones had knit sufficiently so that the cast could be removed, the next stop was the Woodrow Wilson Hospital near Staunton, Virginia. Here, he underwent an operation for removal of the bullet from his arm. At last, the future seemed positive. It was early October 1945. The war was over, both in Europe and in Japan. The boys were coming home. And here he was, Corporal Doss.
"And that isn't all, Corporal," Colonel Connor was saying. "I have a very great honor. I can inform you that you have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, our country's highest honor."
"Sir?" Desmond asked.
I mean...
His voice trailed off. The Congressional Medal of Honor, the nation's highest decoration, presented only to the nation's heroes for outstanding gallantry beyond the call of duty in actual combat. No sailor, no soldier, no marine, no general, no admiral could receive a greater award. Through his mind raced a jumble of conflicting emotions. Gratitude, pride, vindication. He remembered that miserable night in the barracks at Fort Jackson when the army shoes had come hurtling over the bed toward a scared young inductee on his knees in prayer. Now those men and others like them, officers and men he had served with in training and in battle, had recommended him for the nation's highest award. There was sadness, too, and grief. Desmond thought of Clarence Glenn, with that cheerful face that could smile no more. Herb Schechter, whose quiet, sincere voice would never be heard again. Intrepid Captain Vernon, who had given his last order. All the other good buddies who had paid the supreme price. Even at such a moment, Desmond Doss thought of others. They, he thought, were the ones who deserved that honor. And in keeping with his religious convictions, he thought too of the power which had brought him through safety. He bowed his head and gave humble thanks to God. The presentation of the medal was to be made at the White House, several days hence. A few days after Colonel Connor first told Desmond, he met him in the hall again. Desmond still had his PFC stripe on.
"If I ever see that stripe on you again, I'll rip it off myself," the colonel said.
He sent a member of his staff, a lieutenant, to see to it that Desmond was outfitted with a complete new uniform and all the proper regalia. In addition to the corporal stripes on each arm, On his left arm, he wore the Statue of Liberty patch of the 77th Division, two small gold horizontal stripes representing 2 6-month periods overseas, and a diagonal hash mark representing 3 years in the service. Over his left breast pocket, he wore ribbons signifying the Bronze Star for Valor with cluster, the Purple Heart with 2 oak leaves, the Good Conduct Medal, the American Ribbon with 3 bronze stars for the Asiatic Pacific Campaign, Okinawa, Guam, and Leyte with Arrowhead for amphibious landing, and the Philippine Liberation with 1 star. Over this Christmas tree was the Combat Medic Badge. Over his right shirt pocket, he wore the small blue ribbon representing the Presidential Unit Citation given the 1st Battalion, 307th Infantry, for assaulting, capturing, and securing the escarpment. 3 days before the ceremony, a member of the hospital staff brought Dorothy from Richmond to the hospital. The colonel furnished his official command car, with driver, for the 150-mile trip to Washington. Desmond was one of 15 men to be awarded the medal in 1 ceremony on the White House lawn. For 3 days before that, however, they had the run of the town. Desmond and Dorothy, and Desmond's parents, stayed at the Willard Hotel, guests of the United States of America. They had a luxurious suite. Each recipient had assigned to him an officer with practically unlimited funds for entertainment. The officer assigned to Desmond and Dorothy was enthusiastic and eager to please. He wanted to take them to nightclubs, to the best restaurants, to the liveliest places in town. He would go along too, of course. It was not exactly an unpleasant duty. Desmond, however, had learned from his Adventist friends that Elder Richards of the Voice of Prophecy was appearing at Sligo Church in Tacoma Park, a Washington suburb, the 2 nights before the ceremony. To Desmond, Elder Richards' preaching offered more than all the nightclubs, hotspots, and restaurants rolled into one. So his escort, a young Catholic officer who had been looking forward to painting the town red on an unlimited expense account, found himself in attendance at a Protestant evangelistic service 2 nights in a row. Desmond and Dorothy finally permitted their escort to take them to a nightclub after the services were over, and they had a miserable time. They didn't want a cocktail or a highball. They didn't like the way the food was brought in dibs and dabs. They didn't enjoy the floor show, and the idea of spending all that money on such frivolity shocked them both. The sightseeing tour of the city, however, including a boat ride down the Potomac to Arlington, proved most pleasant. Then came the presentation ceremony. Desmond looked around at the other men gathered on the White House lawn. Thanks to his ideas of entertainment, he was unquestionably the freshest one there. One man showed up late with an obvious hangover. Standing rigidly at attention, waiting to approach Harry S. Truman, the President of the United States, and receive a medal, then to receive the congratulations of the General of the Army, George Catlett Marshall, Desmond felt his knees shaking. One man after another stepped forward, heard his individual citation read by the President's aide, then, as newsreel cameramen and newspaper photographers took his picture, received the medal and a handshake from the President. Desmond expected to be nervous, ill at ease, and embarrassed when he met President Truman. His turn came. He walked forward and stopped, as rehearsed, at a line laid in the grass in front of the President. Truman obviously knew Doss's identity. He did something he had not done with the others. He stepped across the line, gave Desmond a hearty handshake, and made him feel at ease. The President held on to Desmond's hand all the time the citation was being read. This is what Desmond heard. Private First Class Desmond T. Doss was a company aide man with the 307th Infantry Medical Detachment when the 1st Battalion of that regiment assaulted a jagged escarpment 400 feet high near Arasamura, Okinawa, Ryukyu Islands on April 29, 1945. As our troops gained the summit, a heavy concentration of artillery, mortar, and machine gun fire crashed into them, inflicting approximately 75 casualties and driving the others back. Private Doss refused to seek cover and remained in the fire-swept area with the many stricken, carrying them one by one to the edge of the escarpment, and there lowering them on a rope-supported litter down the face of a cliff to friendly hands. On May 2nd, he exposed himself to heavy rifle and mortar fire in rescuing a wounded man 200 yards forward of the lines on the same escarpment. And 2 days later, he treated 4 men who had been cut down while assaulting a strongly defended cave, advancing through a shower of grenades to within 8 yards of enemy forces in a cave's mouth, where he dressed his comrades' wounds before making 4 separate trips under fire to evacuate them to safety. On May 5th, he unhesitatingly braved enemy shelling and small arms fire to assist an artillery officer. He applied bandages, moved his patient to a spot that offered protection from small arms fire, and, while artillery and mortar shells fell close by, painstakingly administered plasma. Later that day, when an American was severely wounded by fire from a cave, Private Doss crawled to him where he had fallen 25 feet from the enemy position, rendered aid, and carried him 100 yards to safety while continually exposed to enemy fire. On May 21st, in a night attack on high ground near Shuri, he remained in exposed territory while the rest of his company took cover, fearlessly risking the chance that he would be mistaken for an infiltrating Japanese, and giving aid to the injured until he was himself seriously wounded in the legs by the explosion of a grenade. Rather than call another aid man from cover, he cared for his own injuries and waited 5 hours before litter bearers reached him and started carrying him to cover. The trio was caught in an enemy tank attack, and Private Doss, seeing a more critically wounded man nearby,